Welcome to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. The U.S. has 1,500 Confederate statues. When Ukraine became independent, it had 5,500 statues of just Lenin. We'll talk about when people take statues down. Then we'll find out about a festival that celebrates India's 70th anniversary. And in our global activism segment, how a school for girls persevered through intolerance in Pakistan. Don't forget, you can join the conversation on Twitter at WBEZ Worldview. The president furthered the discussion about the Confederate statues today. He again sided with the white supremacist protesters in Charlottesville. He said on Twitter, "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You can change history. You can't change history, but you can learn from it," he tweeted. We're going to talk about statues and when you take them down and what good it does with Myron Pachuk. He's a priest and depth psychologist, and he studied images and traumas in the former Soviet world. Thanks a lot for joining us, Myron.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to talk about this because it's so interesting. Like, a place like Ukraine has gone and made a law, and they are taking down all the Lenin statues. The Soviet Union went through de-Stalinization, well, took down a lot of statues. Is there a time when that is the appropriate thing to do? Just get down, all the statues down?
I don't know, Jerome. I don't know. If you look at it from different perspectives, it's always good for humanity to have reminders. There has to be some kind of visible or verbal or some kind of written reminder that this is what has happened. You know, why couldn't you take a statue of Stalin and said, yes, this man was viewed officially as this, but this is indeed what the crimes that he committed. Because my fear is that once you just kind of whitewash all of this, you're not able to remember what actually happened. And that's the first step, is to teaching people what happened. If you remember, I couldn't find the link to the site today, this morning, but there was a statue that was put up in Poland with a Red Army soldier pointing his gun in the mouth of a woman lying on the ground. And it was in honor of the millions, literally the millions of women were raped and killed by the Red Army soldiers after the war, from 45 to 48. Of course, you know, I don't know if the statue was standing today. I'd have to research that. But the thing is, the Polish people wanted to express this. They wanted to signify it with something that would remember this horror.
Right. I mean, is there a difference between victims or, you know, even soldiers who die in war and emulating some of the leaders who took you into, you know, a really bad war? Like in the case of the Confederacy, they seceded from the Union. Robert E. Lee said, no, I'm going to resign from the U.S. Army and start my own and fight it. So that's it seems like a different kettle of fish.
It does, but that's the bigger question, you know, that I don't feel that I have an adequate answer for. You know, when you get those extremes, the question is what to do with the extremes. You know, with the extremes, it's not adequate to go affirm one side and the other in totality. So, one has to look at the blank facts and say, this is what has happened as a result of, and you're correct on that.
Is the context of putting up the statue relevant to the discussion? Because it seems like all these Confederate statues were put up in the 20s during the heyday of the KKK, and this was a intimidation tactic that was being used. And there was another rollout of Confederate statues during the Civil Rights era that was meant to intimidate people. All the Lenin statues in Ukraine were clearly meant to intimidate people.
Yeah.
Should you take down these symbols of intimidation?
I think, yes. I'm in agreement with that. I was in the City of Review when they took down the Lenin statue. I'm in agreement with that. Because what you're doing, effectively speaking, is you are destroying an icon of secular religion. And that's important. You know, there's a church in Kiev called St. Alexander. It's a Roman Catholic church. That right beneath it, during the Soviet era, a building was built that was meant to house a statue of Lenin right in the interior of the building to be higher than the top of this church. That did not happen for a variety of reasons. But you're correct in saying when this statue or this image is placed in a godlike position, then we have a problem. And when we teach that teaching of the godlike position that, you know, white supremacy is corrupt, then we have a huge problem because people will be infected by that belief.
Here's another circumstance. I'm sure you're aware of what happened in Georgia. The country of Georgia was the hometown of Stalin was there. And all of even the Soviet Union went through a de-Stalinization process. But Georgia, still today, has a Stalin museum in his hometown. And some people, you know, they're still tearing down Stalin statues. It's controversial. They remember him differently than most of the world remembers him as this leader who killed millions of people, but his hometown kind of remembers him as someone who was robbing from the rich and giving to the poor and sticking it to the czar, and that was our hometown boy. And then he went and made good, I guess, as a leader of the Soviet Union. But the context thing is really strange sometimes.
Well, the context is always going to end up taking us to strange places. But that means, in my opinion, that means that the Georgian people have not had an opportunity to look at the greater context. And then, of course, you know, when you're doing that in the social sphere, as soon as you do that you're going to be accused of racism and other things because people will not accept the ugliness of the truth. You know, and I think that's what's happening with our president. Somewhere along the line, he and his cohort believe in white supremacy. And it's sort of like, well, guys, don't you see it? Don't you see what's going on? Don't you see why is it? You know, I mean, Jerome, we live in Chicago. We live in a city that has experienced multiple levels of different types of racism. And you know, anti-Semitism, certainly, you know, Skokie, what was it, 30 years now? And the question is, you know, what is our responsibility as a society to teach people? And I think we have a huge responsibility. But to do that, I think we need to place philosophers in the spots of politicians.
You know, in kind of digesting this, it seems like people are taking in Balbo Boulevard and the column that was presented to the to Chicago by Benito Mussolini. And people are talking about taking down the column that was presented by fascist Italy by command of Benito Mussolini in the 11th year of the fascist era. And that's what's on this column, which is right down by Soldier Field. And it's a nice Roman column, but it's, you know, not – it seems like that could go.
Well, it could go. A lot of things could go. And it's a teaching moment. But, you know, in the United States, trying to come consensus on teaching moments seems to be more and more difficult. But I think we have a responsibility to stand up and say, you know, we stand for more than justice. We stand for more than justice. You know, it's sort of like, look at it this way, Jerome. We're two white guys talking about a problem that impacts the African-American community. What's that all about? Why is it that – why – you know, I mean, when you think about it.
Sure.
You know, it's one of those, one of the fascinating things that I have learned in the last few years is that when we talk about colonialism, how hidden it is. Colonialism, the whole idea of the human development, the world, the first world and the third world, based upon what? What is societal development based upon? Consumption. Right? One of it is consumption. Well, what does that mean ultimately? What are we doing to, you know, my big thing is, what are we doing to the planet if what you're consuming is destroying so much in that path of life?
Yeah.
And it's hidden. It's hidden. It's in the unconscious. That's the problem, is it's so deep.
Yeah. It's interesting that all our statues are all about political leaders. They're not often about naturalists or about, people who have preserved our environment. Jacques Cousteau would be a nice person to get a monument or something. Now, there's also sports heroes, which seems to be like the only kind of new statues you can build these days.
It's that gladiator spirit, you know. It's part of the narrative. It's the gladiator spirit. You've got to, you know, make America great again by making sure that you beat up this guy. You know, so.
It's interesting to think about. And I wanted to they're about the future. These things are about the future, really, aren't they? The statues and who we want to be.
Absolutely. You know, there's been talk, and I've heard this talk in Western Ukraine too, is, well, what constitutes a memorial today? Well, how do you, is it just a statue of a great poet or a great political leader or a great clergyman, you know, kind of that almost classical venue of interpreting what a memorial should be? I mean, there's other things to memorialize in different ways. I mean, we had our conversation at Chernobyl a few years ago. It goes back to that question of, is Chernobyl a World Heritage Site? And there's growing consensus that it is.
Yeah,
it's not a World Heritage Site because it's positive. It's a World Heritage Site because it's a place of sheer human destruction and the consequences. And I think we need to learn at that. That's why, right. Going back to the statue of the raped Polish woman by the Red Army soldier in Poland, certainly would I want to put up something like that? My first reaction would be, why put a statue there? And it's going to be there all the time, and children will pass by and stuff like that, blah, 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 blah. But the idea is, this is so hidden, so deep, so forgotten.
And I hope we're
beyond that.
Right. Myron Pachuk is a priest and depth psychologist. He studied images and trauma in the former Soviet Union. Thanks a lot for joining us for a discussion about when we take down statues. Thanks. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for today's World History Moment, and we're going to go back to August 17th, 1807. And one of the inventions that I imagine is underplayed these days, we don't think about the old steam engine much, but it was a huge advance for its time. We don't see them anymore, but they were a big deal.
Well, yeah, this is August 17th, 1807. This is the day Robert Fulton launched his steamboat. Now, first thing to do is clear up a common misconception. Robert Fulton didn't invent the steamboat. What he did was make the steamboat commercially practical. It's the same thing that Henry Ford did later on with the automobile. Henry Ford didn't invent the automobile, but he's the one that made it workable. Well, Fulton was an American. He started out as a portrait painter, then he became an inventor. And one of his inventions in 1800 was a submarine powered by a hand crank for the French Navy. And the darn thing worked, but the French decided not to buy it. For various reasons. And fortunately, Fulton already was working on another project. Now, ships throughout history had always been driven by the current of the water or by the wind or by a crew using oars. A few inventors had built boats already powered by a steam engine, but none of them worked very well. But they were clearly going to be the wave of the future. Well, Fulton had a friend named Robert Livingston. The friend had a lot of money, and Livingston had a lot of clout in New York State, and Livingston managed to secure a 20-year monopoly on a possible steamboat service in New York State. So the two men decided to go into the steamboat business. And in 1806, this alliance was cemented when Fulton married Livingston's niece. So Fulton imported a 24-horsepower steam engine from England, and he hired a New York City shipbuilder to construct the wooden hull of this ship. Well, most of the public, when they heard about this, they figured the thing wouldn't work, and they mocked it as Fulton folly. They used to come out to the place where they were building this thing, and they'd laugh, and they'd hoot at them. And a few investors were so scared they would only give money on the condition they remained anonymous. So the ship was finally finished. It was 150 feet long, 13 feet wide, and Fulton called it the Clermont. So the main voyage up the Hudson River from New York City to Albany is scheduled August 17th, 1807. A large crowd gets out there watching, want to see what's going to happen. Fulton gets the engine going, and the Clermont slowly moves into the river, and it stops dead. So, of course, on the shore, the crowd is jeering and laughing and everything. So after about a half hour, Fulton finally got the engine going again, and this time it kept going and it kept going. 150-mile-long journey up the river to Albany. Took 32 hours, but that was quicker than people could do it any other way in those days. And, of course, on the return voyage with the current going with him, it only took 8 hours. Well, within 5 years of Clermont's main voyage, Fulton was operating steamboat service, five major rivers, as well as Chesapeake Bay. And from that time on, shipping was no longer tied to the whims of nature.
Steamboats, bigger advance than you think. You go back in time, and that was really unleashing the power.
It certainly was. The steam engine had only been invented a few years before the steamboat. People had the idea, hey, we're going to put this on, move things around. And, of course, a few years later, they started putting it on land vehicles, moving them on tracks. We had trains. It was a marvelous time for inventions.
Robert Fulton, 1807, and that's the launching of the steamboat. Thanks a lot, John.
Okay.
It's India's 70th birthday, and coming up after the break, we'll talk about India Fest Milwaukee. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. India's marked 70 years of independence on August 15th. There's a variety of events taking place this weekend. We're going to talk about one up in Milwaukee. It's India Fest Milwaukee, the fifth year of India Fest Milwaukee. And Purnima Nath is here. She's chairwoman and president of Spindle India Inc. and producer of India Fest Milwaukee. Nice to talk with you again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back again.
The 70th anniversary, it's a round number. People make a bigger deal of it.
Independence Day is a bigger deal, right? We look at it in a way that where India was during the time it got independence from Brits and where it is now, I think India came a long way. We had nothing, basically. So now, after all these years, India as a country, as a whole, with all these people, with all these issues and etc. I think as a country, we have done tremendously well.
How about yourself, Purnima? Tell us a little about yourself.
I was born in a northeast side of India, and it's completely segregated from mainland India, the little state called Tripura. My upbringing was there until I finished my 12th grade. At that time, there was not a whole lot of good colleges or higher educational institutions in northeast side of India. So ambitious people, much crazy like me, would have to somehow make their path away from that area, go into larger places like Delhi, Mumbai, Pune, Chennai, Bangalore, and then, you know, make their places right there. So that's where I came from. I did my engineering in Tamil Nadu. And the first job right out of college was in Chennai. And then within 6 to 8 months, I was here. And it's 17 years
now. You've been in the U.S. 17 years now.
That's correct. All my experience is here, actually.
And you've been doing India Fest Milwaukee for 5 years.
That
is
correct.
Of your 16 years in this country. What made you want to start an India Fest in Milwaukee?
Milwaukee is such an ethnic place. There is so much going on in terms of Polish Fest, Greek Fest. There's Bastille Day.
There's a lot of German stuff up there.
Exactly. And there's a lot more other fests going on. So why not India Fest? I didn't even call it as an India Fest at that time. I remember when I made my first flyer with the concept in my head, I wrote it down as an Indian Fest. So I started talking to people, giving out flyers and explaining my idea. It was not even there at that time. I was trying to sell an idea, get some buy-ins, get some enthusiastic people together. And very quickly I realized that when I was talking to people that I didn't even know, let's say coffee shop, I went and I was giving a flyer, they're like, oh, what kind of Cherokee you are? So I'm like, okay, that's not going very right in that direction. So it didn't impact in terms of my branding and exercise and communication. So I quickly changed from Indian Fest to India Fest. So that really worked out very, very well.
Cherokees.
Right. And to answer your question, it was more from a perspective that I've been in Milwaukee on and off. I've traveled quite heavily for my work. Base was Milwaukee. I've been into the community, have done a lot of volunteering work and with a professional organization as well as Indian, Asian type of organizations as well. And I also used to go to temple a lot at that time. And I saw that different communities used to do a lot of things in the temple. Like, you know, Tamilians would do their New Year celebrations, Diwali celebrations. Kannadas will do that. Marathis will do that. And Punjabis have Gurdwara. So similarly, I was like, okay, every little community is doing so many different things. And then I was trying to figure out how to bring them all together.
So you pulled Milwaukee's diverse Indian community together.
That's exactly right. So the whole common point is India Fest, Milwaukee bringing communities together.
Do people who are not from the Indian community come to India Fest for fun?
Yes, of course. What I've seen was that beyond my expectation was 50% of our audience is actually American, from Caucasian to Mexican to African American. But I'm thrilled about the attendance. I'm thrilled about how it has been accepted in the community. And people look forward to it. And then it's interesting that even before one ends, people do ask, when is the next one going to be? That kind of indicates that it is in the right path. It is doing very well.
I'm talking with Purnima Nath about India Fest Milwaukee. It's happening on Saturday at Humboldt Park in Milwaukee. I understand you're a singer.
Yes.
Is there music and song and everything happens at India Fest? Sure.
Of course, there's musicians.
Do you sing at India Fest?
Yes. For the last 4 years, I have sung. I have had my own team and my band, my musicians. So I have kept the audience live this year. The only year I will not sing.
How about singing for us right now, though?
Sure. Really? I did not expect that.
Just a little.
Okay. I grew up in the 90s, basically. And during that time, there are a couple of singers who are super popular. And they're still popular. And they do tons of concerts over here in Chicago, Los Angeles, and everywhere else. One of the songs that I truly, truly love forever, a couple lines I'll sing. नजर के सामने जिगर के पास नजर के सामने जिगर के पास कोई रहता है वो हो तुम नजर के सामने जिगर के पास नजर के सामने जिगर के पास कोई रहता है वो हो तुम नजर के सामने जिगर के पास
Purnima Nath from India Fest Milwaukee, doing a great job there on the spot. That's incredible. That's beautiful. And who was that song by and what was it about?
Thank you. I appreciate that. The singer, original singers are Kumar Shanu and Alka Yagnik. Anuradha Padwal. And Kumar Shanu, he is a Bengali from east side of the country. And he is a super popular 90s singer in Bollywood industry, and he is tremendously successful. Initially, he got his fame through Kishore Kumar. That was one of the legend singer, and he took off from that stage and made a fame name in an entire world. I love those songs, basically, those era of songs. And the song meaning is actually, it's a love song.
All right.
And it's a love song. And all the majority of the songs are love song. And then this is all about the lover is saying that you are always in front of my eyes and you are in my heart. You are in me all the time.
Well, I'm sure people will be disappointed not to hear you sing at India Fest Milwaukee this time, but you will have other people doing the entertainment this year?
Definitely. So we're doing quite a few things interesting this time. We are bringing in Ali Pervez, and he is a Bollywood singer as well as music composer. And he worked with famous artists like Atif Aslam, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. So Milwaukee is going to love it. And we're also doing a classical fusion, Hindustani classical concert of Veena. It's the instrument and tabla together. So that's going to be different and interesting. And then we're also continuing with our tradition of Wisconsin Indian Singing Idol that pretty much focuses on the local talents.
But you're not entering.
For me?
Yeah.
No, because there's a few things that goes on in there. Because I started this.
And you win.
Yeah.
Then it'd be bad.
Correct. Yeah. So it is to give opportunity to everybody. And yes, I mean, I am doing my own thing on the side, which I...
Is it mostly dancing?
All of it. Singing, dancing,
everything.
Poetry, piano playing, violin playing.
Oh, it must be fun.
Absolutely. You should come this time.
Well, I will try. I was just in Milwaukee last weekend, though. I was on a bike tour in Milwaukee. It was super fun.
You should come.
I definitely will. Is there any biking involved? Because I usually go when there's biking involved.
Maybe we can plan something next year
that. Kids, you have a lot of kids events, though.
Definitely. The difference of India Fest, if you go to any other event, you will see how the DNA of our organization is different. DNA of our services are different. We try to engage kids. We try to engage the community to do more. And one of the questions from you is that I'm not singing. Yes, but at the same time, even if I'm not singing, I'm behind the scene. I'm doing all the work. I have a few hands. A few of our volunteers are helping in a couple of things like decorations and program lineups and stuff like that. So my role at that time is to make sure that community gets engaged. As a founder of this organization, I understand everybody would also look at me for inspiration and things like that. But at the same time, I participated because of funding issues. If I bring in a external performer, we have to pay, and we didn't have the funding. What I don't have is the, you know, hands, the resources.
Yeah.
Money can solve a lot of problems.
Yeah.
I do not like money. I'm not a fan of money. But, for example, if I had money, I would hire laborers. If I had labor, I can hire. I can set up properly, take down properly, quickly also, and I don't have to pay extra to the park. Those are the things, you know, I need to have a lot of money so I can give back to the community. I think it's not working this way. I have to go this way. So it's like my mindset is I don't like money. I don't want money. I have nothing to do with money. I don't discuss money. Nothing about money. But I get stuck because of money.
Well, I hope a lot of people who are thinking about a trip to Milwaukee get up there and check out India Fest Milwaukee, marking 70 years of independence from India this weekend. It's on Saturday, and people can find it in Humboldt Park, which is really nice.
Definitely. It has a natural amphitheater. The stage is built superbly well, huge, and it is the focal point of our entire event. And it kind of keeps us so integrated around everything that happens through the programs and through the activities, through vendor sales and food and henna or threading, whatever happens. It is about 10 hours of program that we do. It is a continuous program. From morning till evening, there's going to be all local talent. You don't find that kind of opportunity. You don't actually see that kind of opportunity anybody can get anywhere else. I have not seen something like that. This mega scale, a little kid can stand somewhere and thousands of people are seeing him.
Yeah.
You don't see that. And that's why we are different. That's why we are so engaged in the community that those kids, they would never be able to get that kind of opportunity unless they have right connections or, you know, fundings and right. all this, etc. This becomes the platform for talent. This becomes the playground for connections. This becomes the networking collaboration platform. Businesses are doing well. We get connected. We get business awareness, marketing, you name it. This platform is helping everybody, the community. And that's how we're trying to strengthen the community, bring the communities together, bring people together. You know?
Purnima Nath is the founder of India Fest Milwaukee. It is Saturday at Humboldt Park. Thanks a lot for joining us, and people can get more information at indiafestmilwaukee.org. Thank you very much.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, how a girls' school in Pakistan perseveres through intolerance. I'm Jerrell McDonald. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerrell McDonald. It's time for our global activism segment where we feature people who make the world a better place. Let's talk with Iram Shah about the Sonia Shah organization. They're changing the world one girl at a time. And it was the goal of Chicago teen Sonia Shah to open a girls' school in her grandparents' ancestral village in Kangra, Pakistan. And Sonia died in an auto accident in 2012, and her mother and a community of people have made the dream a reality. Nice to see you again, Iram Shah.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the progress on the school there in Kangra, Pakistan. It sounds like a lot of things have happened in the last year.
Yes, we have remodeled the school because there had been an earthquake and flood, so the building was coming down. We have remodeled the school. We have solar panels that is supplying electricity 24 hours to the school.
Where is Kangra, Pakistan? People have no idea there's earthquakes. It needs solar panels for electricity.
Yes, it is quite a small village in the northwest of Pakistan, and the region is called Pakhtunkhwa. It is close to the tribal area. And not only this village, but the villages around it has been left behind. And though it was our ancestral village, we left 70 years ago, and we never went back. But Sonia wanted to go back, and she could have started her mission here or in a bigger city in Pakistan. It would have been much, much easier. But she chose that part because she wanted to end the discrimination and suppression of women in that part of the world. And she wanted to take a piece of America, a piece of our values of equality and justice, regardless of your gender, to that village. And I'm so happy that we have made a lot of progress, even though there was a lot of resistance. And today we have trained 100 women in our vocational center, really enabling them to become financially independent. We had a medical camp late last year, where we did a medical examination of all the children. We provide vitamins and supplements to the children in the school because we don't want them to take the medicine at home because we don't know how they're going to take it or who will take it.
I noticed on your blog that one of the young women had a congenital heart issue. Do these people see doctors ever regularly?
Not really. The inoculation happens because the government sends someone once a year. But there are no doctors nearby. And especially, it's sad to say that that girl had five sisters. And sisters and girls are always second-class citizens. So I'm quite sure that she never went to school or to the doctor. So they did not know. But when we checked with the family, her father died of heart problem. Her other brother had the same problem. Huh. But unfortunately, they would not let her daughter to have a surgery, even though we wanted to pay for it.
Oh, really?
And that tells you how far behind they are. So it's going to change. We tried. We had a donor who was willing to pay for the surgery. We had a doctor who was willing to give free services, but her brother would not let that happen, partly because he didn't want her to go to the city for the surgery, and they made all excuses, and I talked to them for a long period of time. Nothing came out of it. So we gave up, but I'm keeping an eye because she's a very good student in our school. You will see a lot of her pictures, and I'm keeping an eye, and I'm going in December, and I'll give it another try.
You mentioned the other progress that you've been making there.
Yeah, one of the biggest, and I did touch on the solar panels, why it had such a major impact is that, one, it's providing light and electricity to the school. And in that village, electricity comes and goes. And in summer, it's like 4 hours out of 24 hours. So imagine in the heat of 100 degree Fahrenheit, when there's no electricity and no water, we are able to run our filtration plant and provide clean drinking water to the villagers. And in summer, when the Ramadan was, we were able to hook some coolers to the filtration plant. So we provided not only drinking water, but cold drinking water. And that had a really positive impact. The other thing that I was kind of surprising for me was when we gave uniforms to the students, it was just amazing impact. Our registration went out. Because imagine, some of these kids don't have decent pair of clothes. And when we gave them two pairs of clothes and shoes, they couldn't stop smiling.
They've got something to come into school in.
Yes, it was kind of more than that. It was like giving them an identity that they didn't have before and self-confidence. So that was very, very high impact on our school and vocational center, as I said. In U.S., our first recipient of scholarship, Sonia Shaw Scholarship, will be graduating next spring.
That's terrific, because you do four scholarships per year here in the U.S.
Yes, and we try to do as many, but it depends on the funds. And we don't want our girls, you know, stranded, because if we don't have funds, then we cannot complete their studies. So we make sure whoever we take, that we can support them at least for 2 years, if not 4 years.
And so that's for young women who don't have the wherewithal for college in this country.
Yes. So in U.S., you can be anyone from any background, whoever you are. If you are struggling to go to college because your economic condition, you cannot borrow a loan or scholarship, you can apply to Sonia Shaw Scholarship Program.
I'm talking with Iram Shah about the Sonia Shaw Organization. They're changing the world one girl at a time. And you've seen some terrorism there in Kangra, Pakistan. And you've been thinking about the things that have happened to your school there and the United States here.
Yes. Last week was a difficult week for me because I started making connections, which might seem really far-fetched for a lot of people. But I've seen terrorism up close. And I started to see the connection between what happened last week.
Charlottesville.
Yes, and what happened in Kangra, at least in my school. Our school was attacked twice. The first time when it was bombed, our school was destroyed, almost half of it. And the reaction was from my friends and enemies saying, stop, you can't do this. You cannot win this battle from terrorists. And you need to go to either bigger city or go back to U.S. And we said no, because that was the whole purpose of Sonia, going to that part of the world. And we said, no, we're not going to do that. And we rebuilt the school. The second time when it happened, there was no destruction, but it created so much fear that we lost, meaning 150 kids stopped coming to school the next day. So we had 150 children one day. And the next day, we had only 20 children showing up. The teachers stopped coming. And the villagers got very upset with us because they thought that we have brought terrorism to village. They were living comfortably safe in their ignorance. And by bringing the school to girls, we have not made their lives unsafe. And then again, my family and people and well-wishers said, Iram, you got to stop. You got to move out. And I got a lot of threats, text messages from people who didn't want that school to go on. And some of my friends and myself, we said, no, we are not going to stop. And this time we brought guards, 24-hour guard. We put security cameras. We hired a social mobilizers who went door to door to tell people that we cannot back down, that we cannot let terrorists win, and that it's good for their children. And then the parents reacted, said, okay, we'll send you someone, but not girls. We'll send you boys. And we said, okay, you can send your boys, but every boy brings two girls. And every woman in a vocational center brings one girl, either daughter, niece, granddaughter. And at that time, we had 60% boys and 40% girls. And latest numbers are, is flipped. So we have 60% girls and 40% boys. And I'm hoping it's going to be 90% girls very soon. And I cannot say that we conquered terrorism because you cannot do it so quickly. But I feel that we have made a lot of progress. And the reason we made progress, and that's my connecting point, is that we had to stand up and call it and condemn it and really do something about it. If you think about Pakistan, you know, several years ago, a couple of decades ago, it was a pretty safe country. I mean, yes, we had our share of wars, but terrorism was not there. Then we started seeing small faction of people who we didn't call terrorists. We just said they were extreme religious people with extreme ideas who started talking loud and small acts of violence. And most of the reaction was they were either people were either afraid or we said, let's minimize. This is just isolated case. It's not going to have an impact and it'll go away. And others ignored or left. And before we knew it, got escalated from, you know, just single shooting. If you remember, Malala was shot in Swat, from killing artists and journalists and volunteer workers in the broad daylight to killing 144 children in one day in one school in Peshawar. And that was the time when people kind of stood up and said, this is enough. We can't take it. And they demanded from the government to do something about it. But it was a bit too late then. We are still coming out of it. I think conditions are getting better. But we were completely destroyed from the terrorism. So I think it's important for us, whenever something like that happened, to start making connections, because other countries may be a little bit advanced in that journey and how they have suffered. And what can we do to stop the violence and do something about it?
I'm talking with Iram Shah about the Sonia Shah Organization. They're changing the world one girl at a time. And their event is September 16th, a night of celebration and joy. It's taking place at the Logan Square Auditorium. And we're talking about the experiences she's had in Pakistan and how they relate to experiences we're having now in the U.S. What would you like to see people do in the U.S.? What do you think people should have done in Pakistan that they could do now in the U.S.?
I think the first thing, which seems so obvious, is to call a spade a spade. There are things that are gray and there are things that are black and white. And I think true leaders are the ones who can see the black and white ahead of everyone else and do something about it. Because history is quite black and white. Because hindsight is 20/20, and history is always with the oppressed. And I feel like wherever you are, whether you're a common person or you're a business leader or you're a political leader, this is a time that we are making history for America. And whether we like it or not, America is a leader in this world. And what we do and how we do is being watched. So I would say we are being watched by the world. History is watching us, and we have to decide what side of history we'll end up.
You work for a large Fortune 500 corporation, and I know that a lot of people are looking at what is happening with the Manufacturing Strategy Council and the Strategic and Policy Forum, and Donald Trump disbanded them, people were quitting. These people at least resigned over what they saw happen after Donald Trump's remarks after Charlottesville.
Yeah, so there is a lot of commotion, and we can say that things are being disturbed, but I personally was very encouraged as a businesswoman to see business leaders and CEOs standing up, denouncing and condemning the events from last week. And I think it's a good human logical reaction, but it's also good business because companies are realizing quickly that the market is changing and it's being shaped by socially conscious customers. Our millennials are very different. They are not only demanding high-quality product with good services, with good price. They're looking for companies to have a purpose, to eradicate social evils. And it's not enough to just deliver top line, bottom line. And even investors are changing in how they invest. So I think these CEOs are very smart, and it's not just driven by human reaction, but it's also driven by the fact that they want to lead companies that lead the market.
They might pay a price, though, like people pay a price in Pakistan. If people stand up, they might pay a price.
Yes, but I think it's a pretty safe calculation right now, because the difference between the right and wrong is so big. And to me, it's very simple. If you go back to our values, American values, and if anything is outside those values, then it's wrong. So for them, it's a very simple way to calculate. And eventually, I think people who follow the values and stand for it, they're respected, even if in the short term they suffer.
I noticed you were out working with Jimmy Carter, out there building houses with Jimmy Carter.
Yes. So Jimmy Carter was a hero of my daughter. And Sonia read almost all of his books. And she introduced me to Carter Center and to a lot of his books, forced me to read some of it because they're pretty thick, some of them. And so it was a big honor for me to meet him in Canada. And this was sponsored by my company, Schneider Electric. He does Carter Project every year. And this time I was fortunate to work with him and his wife, Rosalind. And it was amazing to see him at 92 standing outside in the sun, 8 hours working, cutting wood. And it was just amazing experience. And I think he will go down as one of the best American president with a legacy that is very hard to follow.
He's got pretty good values.
Yes, yes. One thing that I like about him, and I think it's not just enough to have clarity of vision and mission and values, you have to be courageous to speak about it and to do something about it. And there are not too many people who fall in that category.
I wanted to talk a little about the event you're having. It's on September 16th, a night of celebration and joy. You're going to have some fun.
Yes. Our annual gala is on the 16th of September at Logan Square Auditorium. And the theme of this, because we always have a theme, and this time our theme is celebration and joy because of the progress we have made, and we are celebrating the lives of the girls in Pakistan and here that have changed because of education and empowerment. We are celebrating two poets and their poetry who belongs to that part of the world. And one is Ahmed Faraz. He's an internationally renowned poet. And the other lady is Shadab Hashmi. Ahmed Faraz lived and died in Pakistan, and Shadab lives in U.S. And both have poetry that will give us glimpses of that part of the world and glimpses of the girls at the school. And then it'll be followed by, of course, dinner and music and dancing. So please come and join us, and don't forget to put on your dancing shoes.
Who's your MC?
Oh, one of the MCs is Ruby, and Ruby Rizwan, and she is a 14-year-old girl who I believe is a leader in her generation. And why I say that she heard my interview here on NPR a year ago, and her mother, Monica, reached out to me and say, Ruby really wants to do something, and she has collected the $600, and she wants to give to the organization. And when I met with Ruby, I knew instantly she needs to be part of Sonia's organization. She so much reminded me of Sonia. So she has been, and her mother have been very engaged with Sonia's organization since then. In fact, her mother is helping me with the event, and Ruby is going to be emceeing our event.
No, that's terrific. That's an extra bonus for me. Well, I hope a lot of people will come out on September 16th, a night of celebration and joy with the Sonia Shah Organization. It's taking place at the Logan Square Auditorium at 6 p.m. on 2500 North Kedzie Boulevard. And people can visit the soniashahorganization.com website and get more information about the event. And it's been great to see you, Iram Shah. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The big solar eclipse is Monday, and it's Monday during this program. So what can we do but devote our program to the solar eclipse? And one of the things we want to do to psych up for the solar eclipse is hear stories of people who have previously seen a total solar eclipse. We're going to play the stories on Monday's program. Call our hotline and tell us your story. Tell us what it was like, where you were, what you saw. Here's the number, 888-915, like our radio station, 915-2270. That's 888-915-2270. Tell us your total eclipse story. Tomorrow on Worldview, we'll talk a bit about Iran and the 1953 overthrow of the president in Iran by the U.S., backed by the U.S. We'll talk about that tomorrow on Worldview. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. Thanks to Mike Gilmore for engineering. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You've been listening to Worldview from WBEZ.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.